we can start. So welcome, I'd like to reintroduce Bob Rossi, and he is going to continue in his series with the cross-spiritual exercises. So thank you very much for coming, and we'll turn it over to Bob.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to keep these open, and if it gets noisy, I'll close, but there might be a breath in there.
I was on dish crew this morning, pots and pans.
Yes.
And the young lady who was my boss said after a couple of minutes, are you the faculty member that's doing the thing on suffering? And I said, yes, I am. And then one of the gentlemen who was in the kitchen, who was working there, popped in and he said, is that why they assigned you to this? And I said, no, it's just that I like to speak from experience. I'm happy to be with you. Yesterday, we had the first session. Yesterday's session was about the issue of suffering, why suffering. So we went through major religions of the world with their different points of view, and talked a lot about what's going on in the world, what is it that people are facing, both personally and communally, societally. So yesterday was a kind of introduction to suffering, to get people kind of in touch a little bit with the context that we want to speak out of. This, what you receive, what you have in your hands, is really a pastoral tool to accompany people in personal suffering. So I don't know if any of you know the Ignatian exercises, but these exercises belong to our religious community. We're the Order of the Holy Cross, 800 years old. Can't tell by looking, but it's true. And the thrust of our particular community is to stand by suffering people with a word of hope. And so we have developed, over 800 years, a lot of theological reflection and pastoral technique to help people who are in suffering. So this particular course of spiritual exercises, people will ask me, 800 years now, who wrote these? They were written 10 years ago when I did it. Mm-hmm. But they come out of that tremendous tradition, and so we have lots to offer you, and I hope that you will appreciate. Now, this is only the second, so there will be a third. The third one on Friday will be a much more hands-on kind of the technique. Some of it's already in that booklet there. But I want to talk today about the theological background of this particular pastoral instrument. And I want to do it in such a way that prepares us to see how we might accompany persons who are suffering in any way. But we use these exercises regularly. They have great impact. They're not easy to do, as you're going to find out from today. But they are very, very New Testament based, and I think helpful to many people. So we have people coming to spiritual exercises who are who have had cancer or are struggling with marriage or have some other tragedy in their life or an addiction, and so we use the time to work them through. This does take time. This is not just a kind of one shot where they come in and you talk to them and they get all the answers they ever wanted to know. It is an actual accompaniment that demands a great deal of personal effort. So I want to deal with this right now in terms of the four movements of these spiritual exercises. So there are four movements, and these four movements are characterized by a teaching and then a task. So once we expose a kind of base for thinking and praying and believing, then we ask the participants to enter into it with regard to their personal suffering. So a lot of it does have to do with personal reflection. We help people then, after reflection, speak to God and will discover they need to know which God to talk to. And then there is, for every participant, a personal director whom we call a cross coach. And this is a person who follows the individual regularly through the exercises. So those three conversations really are the heart of the spiritual exercises. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask, and don't be afraid to intervene while we're talking. I have no problem with that. So let's talk about the first movement, which we have called Via Sacris. Now, this Latin, you know, people like these mystical kinds of things, so we gave these movements Latin names. Via Sacris really is that the way we talk about the journey of Jesus, basically from Pilate's house to his death, that, you know, the way in Jerusalem is called the Via Sacris. And this movement is focused on the fact that Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem, which basically means he was facing death. Okay, he knew why he was going. So in this first instruction, we want to understand the cross journey. And I'd like to just take you through some basic insights here that help us understand. By the way, when these exercises speak of cross, they're speaking of an experience of suffering, whatever. We name that cross, but that's what it really means. So I'd like to begin by talking about Jesus. Now, Jesus, of course, for his whole life, was aware that he would eventually die for the people. So his whole mentality was the mentality of the suffering servant of the Old Testament, you know? And so he lives his life among us with that mentality. And not only with the mentality, but he's constantly being confronted by the reality. So as he moves about amongst the people, you know, he's dealing with all the evidences of human brokenness. He's dealing with people who are sick, dealing with people possessed, dealing with people who are confused, dealing with people who are off the map when it comes to religious understanding of what God wants, that sort of thing, you know? So he's constantly dealing with it. And he himself is feeling it. So he's had many experiences of, for example, personal disappointment when he sees his disciples not getting it, when there's so little faith amongst the others, he's done all these signs. I got to the point where he goes up to the top of the mountain and cries his heart out, weeps over Jerusalem. He feels betrayed. He has nowhere to lay his head. So this is a man, especially Mark's gospel, by the way. Mark's gospel is the gospel of the suffering Jesus. Every one of the gospels has its own perspective, but this one is, Mark's gospel is really that you see the suffering Jesus in many, many aspects, and the Jesus who wants to do something about it. So he's a hands-on, roll up your sleeves, Jesus who takes care of difficulty. In any event, his life is marked by his eventual cross experience, and he's already participating, even when he was a kid, you know, in Bethlehem, this little kid that had to be born in very unusual circumstances. The parents had to flee to Egypt. You know, all those stories really want to tell us, in effect, who he is. And then comes, of course, the actual moment of what we consider his passion, death, and resurrection. And prelude to those moments are his, you know, the supper with his disciples, the agony in the garden, the trial, all that. But really, his Via Sacris, his way, begins with the condemnation to death by Pilate. So this, he receives that condemnation, and he makes his way to Calvary. This is what we have come to call in our tradition of the Via Sacris of Jesus. So he begins with the condemnation and he moves through his life. Now, there are many things that you'll be able to read in the book that we won't be able to deal with, but I want to use that model, Jesus from Pilate to his death and then of course beyond to his resurrection, because in effect that is also Via Sacris for the Christian. Baptism begins in baptism for us. The Christian life begins in baptism and ends in the final kingdom. So we're on our way. Baptism is in effect, is a death sentence for Christians. It's shocking to hear that sometimes, but it's true. It's a death sentence. Why? Well, we see that the Christian, once baptized, chooses a way to final glory that is full of death experiences. The Via Sacris of the Christian is as painful as the Via Sacris of Jesus, from the death sentence to the final destination. So when we're talking about the Christian making his or her way after baptism toward the final kingdom, it is like Jesus's way. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Now, as we're baptized, and we make our vows to walk a certain way, the substance of our struggle is really linked to three human passions, the basic human passions. This is classical Christian spirituality, and I suspect classical spirituality with other traditions as well. There is the passion of ownership, wonderful passion inside us that we have to get, to own, to possess, wonderful, because we wouldn't be able to live our lives without that. We need security. God gave us that possibility. However, what happens to it? And this is, as we spoke a little bit about yesterday, this is one of the effects of the sin of Adam, that this passion got completely disoriented, so that now people, instead of just taking what they need for themselves, take what the others need and don't give a rip about it. So you have this terrible imbalance in human life between the haves and the have-nots, and getting people to understand, you know, that we're all here and we're all on our way and we all should be doing this together, but boy, this ownership thing creates great difficulty for us. See, wars. The second passion that is critical on the Christian walk is the passion for relationship. And of course, this is a wonderful passion. This is the passion of love. This is the passion of being connected, the passion of belonging. This is wonderful, but what happens to it? What generates between people is not necessarily love. Sometimes it's abuse. It's violence. It's war. So this wonderful thing about being connected becomes completely distorted. And we live our lives facing that. Also, freedom. This is the passion that God gave us to achieve our destiny. So you and I have the possibility of choosing. So we can say yes and no. And it's all related to getting to our destiny. The big problem here, of course, is that I might be so interested in my destiny that I simply disregard yours. It's called power struggle. It's the abuse of power. I use my power to get where I want, and the rest of you, good luck. Now, the reason why we bring this up is because this characterizes the Via Sacris of the Christian. Practically every experience of crisis, of decision, is related to one of these three passions in our lives. So as the Christian makes his way from baptism to final kingdom, there are all these challenges with regard to the stuff that's most basic to us. In effect, every time we meet one of these challenges, one of these crises, really, it's a moment of decision. So how will I decide? So with regard to my stuff, moments in my life where I have to make decisions about my stuff that's related to not just me, but who we all are and who God is. It's the same with relationship. So every time we enter into a relationship and it begins to break down or it is a difficult relationship, we have to make decisions about it. So there are some decisions we can make. I'll just kill you. But there are other decisions we can make. So everyone, you see the Christian moving along in his via sacris is constantly having to make decisions about which way to go. And the issue of freedom, of course. We're all moving freely, but there may be moments when we have to say, wait a minute, what am I doing here? What's my decision doing to the others? Family, society, whatever. These moments of decision are occasions of death. That's why we say baptism is a death sentence. They are moments of death. So you have to die to something to keep moving toward the kingdom. But if you get stuck, if you're in temptation about this or that, and you make a decision to resist goodness, grace, you won't go anywhere. If you decide against your temptation, against the evil that you are confronted with, it means you have to die. You're dying to something in order to keep rising. And that is basic, one of the most basic insights behind these spiritual exercises is that the Christian is constantly facing the decision to die in order to rise.
Is that a dying, would you call it dying to self?
Yes. So whatever it is in me that would push me in the wrong, I die to. Just those are moral decisions we make all the time. And they're fundamental. They're fundamental to how the world works. The kinds of decisions I make affect how the world works. I mean, all this stuff, you know, that we have going on about the ecological problems, all the problems of violence and war, all the problems of who has what in our world are all related to our decisions about how we're managing stuff. So the Christian journey is really an invitation to die constantly. They are, these decisions, occasions of death for us. How do we get through it? This is, the Christian, you know, by baptism has made the decision to walk the way. And so he or she is meeting all of these challenges of. So here I'm confronted with something. So how do I know how to die? Which is the decision I should make? Is there any guidance? Well, there is. First of all, there's guidance from the gospel. And the fundamental guidance from the gospel has to do with the three evangelical councils. Let's just say poverty of spirit, evangelical obedience, and chastity. And I want to talk just about those three things because all of them are lights that go on when we are facing our issues. So the evangelical poverty business has to do with, look, whatever security you're all messed up about getting it and keeping it, you know, suppose you accepted that God is your Father and will care for you. Suppose that were the context. Your decisions, you see, might be different. You might not grab. You might find a way in faith to say, I don't need to grab. So that's the evangelical poverty in the New Testament. That, you know, there is this whole concept that, you know, we are the children of our Father, and our Father's caring for us. So why are we grabbing? with regard to evangelical obedience, the issue is, you know, so when I'm making decisions, there is a great destiny that all of us have. And that destiny is, God is constantly calling that, that's the final kingdom. And so my decisions should always be made in light of that. I need to decide, after listening to God, that's obedience. I decide after listening to God. So the Christian, the ideal Christian point of view is, I will not take one step without listening to God. And with that kind of perspective, you see, you can avoid, you will avoid going awry, but it will mean death for you. It's an experience of death. If I choose that direction, I'm going to die to something in me. And then chastity. It's interesting, chastity. Most of us feel that chastity has to do with sex. Non-sex, I mean. Celibacy or something like that. And actually, chastity is an expression of the whole giving of oneself to God and to all that is of God. So in the New Testament, this chastity represents this kind of purity of intention, purity of action. And of course, one of our weakest links is our sexual life. So we're often falling there. But chastity really is a way to love. A way to love God. A way to love, and love, in this sense, all people without distinction. That's the ideal of evangelical chastity. When we're loving God and loving His own, we're doing it without distinction. Boy, talk about going along the road. You see, so having to die to this kind of, I will attach myself to whom I wish for whatever reason I wish. You know, have to die to that. So that's all along our life we have these things. So there are those evangelical counsels. So we Christians are not in the dark as we walk. The lights go on. And they come from the gospel. These are fundamental things that Jesus says belong to the whole community. And then there are three church pillars in Acts that I think are very helpful. When you look at that community in Jerusalem initially and how it lived, these are great guiding principles. And they're related to these three evangelical councils. But for example, that early Christian community came together in faith. So there was brotherhood, sisterhood, fellowship, community. See, on the walk, anything that destroys community is not of God. When I'm making decisions about who I'm with or not with, it makes a difference. The second thing they were very concerned about was the teaching of the apostles. So they were very keen on the fact that they were in touch with the eyewitnesses, and the doctrine of the apostles was what was the kind of kingpin. That's what they reflected everything back to that. Well, that's Christian formation. If we receive a formation that keeps us true to the teachings of the apostles, lights go on. That's where we're on. Journey. And then the third thing was interesting is this, the sense of giving themselves to prayer and the breaking of the bread. You know, as a Christian makes his or her way through life, this issue of being a prayerful person, but also being a prayerful person in community, and especially around the table, with all our Eucharistic theology, you know? So as we move, yeah, and everything the Eucharist means, because the Eucharist is very related to this death business. It's this community around the table is the community that's dying to self and rising to Christ Jesus all the time. So these things, you know, we keep in our heads and that become kind of lights for us. And so they help us make decisions as we're going that are the right decisions, that are the forward-moving decisions, but always involve the death. Death to my ego. Death to my point of view, death to desire. It's tough being a Christian. It's not for kids. Well, it is. But it's not really for kids. It's for adults who have attached themselves to Christ Jesus, his salvific work and mission, and who make the, do the walk. And so, all along, we are suffering. Every experience that we have has some relationship to these three passions. We'll get into that a little bit later. And they make a big difference about how we deal with our experience of suffering in life. Because the experience of suffering can be the experience that throws us over the cliff. Or the experience that leads us on high, if you want to put it that way. Therefore, as we are moving in our Via Sacris, you and I, if we are deciding for life, and against death, we're being transformed. Constant transformation in our Christian lives. So baptism is one thing. There is a transformation. But you know, we're on our way. None of us are in the final kingdom. And so we have this experience, and every time you and I decide for right, for goodness, for love, for peace, for joy, every time we decide, we are being transform more deeply. So every death that we experience on our way is also a moment of some kind of resurrection. This dying and rising business is what we're all about with these spiritual exercises. Let's talk a little bit about the problem of evil. I mean, why should we be suffering? I mean, this is a big deal. Everybody around the world is asking this question. Why? Why suffering? What's the problem? There's something wrong. We know it from the time you get up in the morning. In the garden, there was nothing wrong. In all the dimensions of our life, physical, moral, spiritual, emotional, social, it was wonderful. That's why we call it the Garden of Eden. Once out of the garden, because of the no of Adam and Eve, there's... Why shouldn't we be able to get along? Why can't everybody have what he or she needs? Why all of this turmoil inside and around us? There's something wrong. And all of us are wondering, how do you get it right? How do you get it right? How is this whole thing going to be remade? And that's the question of goodness being reborn. Goodness was created by our Father. We damaged it. Can it be reborn again? Or are we stuck? Can it be reborn? Big question. And it's everybody's question. You don't have to be a Christian to have this question. All of the world religions have this question in their own perspective, you know? It's like, look, we gotta get from where we are to someplace else. I mean, where we are is not great. The Buddhists say, you know, human desire is killing us. Hindus, illusion is killing us. Islam, non-submission to Allah is killing us. So how do you get to where it's okay again? And that's the issue. So I want to talk about this because the answer to that question for us Christians, and Judeo-Christians actually, both the whole tradition, has to do with a paradox. And the paradox is this, and we are scandalized by it. The early church was scandalized by it. Christians were scandalized all along by it, that life comes through death. I want to show you a little bit about that. Now, you say, where'd that come from? Well, look at nature. The rhythm of nature is life coming through death. The four seasons, one dies. Little baby in his mother's womb. Nice in there, comfy, got everything you need. If that baby doesn't come out, there's no life. That baby has to die to its mother's womb. Little kid wants to learn to walk. You know how they are, they hang on to daddy's leg. If that kid hangs on to daddy's leg his whole life, the kid's never going to have any locomotion. The kid has to die to his daddy's leg in order to be independent. You see, there's death in everything, all the way through. Some of you are married. Not yet. You're looking forward to this. There could be 1,000 potential spouses. Wonderful people. In order to have an authentic and deeply human relationship, which we call marriage, you have to let go of 999 of them and accept the ones you have to die to 999. And I mean, this is the way it is. And it's all the way through life like this, that we're dying constantly, naturally, to things. Some of you are retired. You can't have a decent retired life if you're still engaged in your work. Yeah. Eventually, we will all die, period. See, we can't stay here. Life ends here. There's some, you know. So this issue of the, what's the big scandal about the Paschal mystery? Death coming from life. There's no scandal about it. For in nature, we see it all the time, all over the place. And it is revealed the first time in Genesis 3:15. You know that text, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and hers. He shall strike your head, and you shall lie in wait for his heel. Wonderful text. Very, you know, obscure, but wonderful text. And behind this text is a Semitic understanding, a Semitic experience. It's the experience of a man living in a village that has been terrorized by a serpent. Now, this village, you know, wants the kind of peace that lets mom go to the well every day for the water, lets the kids play in the street, but that snake, that serpent is there, and it's terrorizing the whole village. Here comes a man from that village walking down a road, dusty road, in his bare feet, and there's the serpent. And he thinks, this is it. I can take care of this. He raises his foot, and he brings it down on the heel of the serpent, but what happens? The serpent bites his heel. Serpent is dead. Village is free. Mom, kids, but at the cost of the death of that man. That's what's behind this text. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and hers. He shall crush your head, and you shall lie in hate. That's the image. This is exactly the story of Jesus Christ. That's why in traditional Christian theology, this text is called the Proto-Evangelium, the first proclamation of the gospel. This is how it happens. This is how goodness is born in the world. Death brings about goodness. And so Jesus identifies with this, obviously. This is how it happens. And this is something that was his personal drama. When we talk about Paschal mystery, it sounds like a theological concept. It was a theological concept. It was a personal experience of Jesus Christ dying in order to rise. And this dying in order to rise, the scriptures tell us, was the saving act of God. Did you get that? The saving act of God. It's what brought life. His death saved. This Paschal mystery business is behind all of the sacramental life of the church. All of the sacraments, in whatever tradition you are, all of those sacraments are expressions of Paschal mystery. Why? Well, let's take an example. A sacrament is a sign that does what it tells. It's a ritual action that has a message that accomplishes what the message is saying. So it does what it tells. In the early church, baptism. We didn't just pour water. We didn't just sprinkle. What'd they do? They took you down to the river. Minister takes a hold of you. Into the water you go. Holds you under. What happens if you hold somebody underwater?
They die.
Finished. But the minister whoosh, pulls the person up. You see, the sign was the sign of dying and rising. And that is exactly what happens in grace to the person. And whatever the sacraments you celebrate, you can find the roots of this past. That's the way it is. There's no other way that we can enter into this contact of glory and be transformed. There's no other way. It's always death through life. So the whole theology of our sacraments is founded on the experience of Paschal mystery. And then, of course, every Christian personally, every Christian needs to take account of this. I mean, so it becomes a personal spirituality for all of us. You know, some of us wear crosses. In our Catholic tradition, we, you know, have crucifixes and crosses in our homes. And that's ridiculous. But when you think about that, why would you use the symbol of capital punishment to somehow indicate heavenly blessing? That's what it is. That's why they use it. When I'm baptizing, the first gesture of baptism in our rite is bring the baby up, lovely kid. Hope he, you know, or she stays quiet, but lovely kid. First gesture on the forehead of that kid is traced the sign of the cross. First gesture. And then everybody else in the community is invited to do the same. Now, why would you do that to a baby? Because that's the way it is. That's how this child is going to come to glory. So personal spirituality for all of us, eventually we have to think about it as our way. I have a little meditation for you now about Jesus, what went on in his life, and what went on in his death and his resurrection. These are based on the Catholic Stations of the Cross. There are 14 of them. Some of them have biblical context. Some of them have only traditional mythical. But these are the 14. I just put them up here because the little meditation uses those 14. Jesus condemned, carries his cross, falls the first time, beats his mother, Simon's ring takes the cross, Veronica wipes the face of Jesus, leaves her image on the veil. Jesus falls the second time, Jesus meets the women of Jerusalem, Jesus falls the third time. Jesus is stripped of his garments, Jesus is nailed to the cross, Jesus dies on the cross, and Jesus is taken down from the cross, and then Jesus is laid in the tomb. And what I want to do here is just have a little meditation on what happened to Jesus causes something to happen to us, so please enjoy that. want to show you this to emphasize this Paschal mystery business. That, you know, the sorrowful, painful, whatever is what leads to life. That's what Jesus did for us. And so this is just a kind of a meditation, a parable about that to support the notion of Paschal mystery in our lives. So that's the Via Sacris. I'd like to move on, and we'll move a little more quickly through the other movements. The second movement is called Calvaria. Calvaria, the place of Calvary, of course. And it says he went out to what is called the place of the skull. But this place of the skull becomes important because the skull place is the experience of all of us. We all find ourselves in skull places. That is to say, places where we feel crucified or about to be crucified. And that's another name for suffering, another name for the experience of the cross, to be in a skull place. And there are skull places all over, around. Life is out of joint, as we said. And that's the reason why we find ourselves in skull places, in places of suffering, in places of difficulty, challenge, and temptation, and sin, and struggle, and pain. Life is out of joint. We all experience skull places. And these skull places exist in all the dimensions of our life. So our bodies can be a skull place. Got a headache? Got cancer? Are incapacitated? Your body is a skull place for you. The mind. Get confused. Make wrong judgments. Can't figure things out. The mind can be a skull place for people. There are people who suffer terribly because of their minds. Feelings. Oh boy. Feelings are a skull place for us. All kinds of feelings. Sometimes feelings are completely out of control in our lives. You know, we can't manage. It's a skull place. And lots of people suffer terribly in their feeling life. It's a skull place. It's a place of crucifixion for people. Relationships. Oh. You know those moments when it's difficult between you and the spouse or you and your friend or whatever, or in your community or whatever? The enemy. Our relationships become skull places. People suffer terribly. Some of the most excruciating pain in human life is the pain that comes with a broken relationship. It's excruciating. It's a skull place. Our will. You have an addiction? Get over it. What? Get over it. You mean,
just so you know.
Don't have this, you know. And not only that, as Paul says, you know, we do things that we know we shouldn't do. What is it? You know, it's a skull place. And for people, for a lot of people, there are lots of skull places in this area of the will, the capacity to make decisions. And the spirit. The spirit can be a skull place for us. Can't pray. Lose your faith. Despair. I mean, the relationship with God, shouldn't that be wonderful and glorious? Yes, but there are people who suffer terribly. So when we're talking about the experience of a Christian, you see, just like the experience of Jesus, we get to a point in our lives, and often, where each of these kinds of challenges, difficulties, stresses, pains, become skull place for us. It's where we feel crucified. The issue is, can we get out of it? How? And not only that, Christian witness can be a skull place for us. You open your mouth publicly about a gospel value, what happens? Go to some parts of the world. I've lived in Africa. I've lived in Asia and in South America. Now, I tell you the stories of the people, the good people, driven to their deaths because of their witness. Now, see, why should that be? I mean, all of us feel like, well, God, I gave myself to you. I'm one of yours. So what's this big deal? Why isn't it all going great for me? It doesn't. because the Christian life is also a struggle for us. And we can find ourselves in small places simply because we're Christians. Well, it sounds unfair. A lot of people think it's unfair. And some people leave religion, leave the church for that reason. As St. Teresa of Avila, a medieval mystic, said, if this is the way you treat your friends, it's no wonder you have so few. That's what she said to God. It's true, isn't it?
How does this address the Acts lesson of 2 weeks ago? As Paul's preaching in a strange place, he isn't going anywhere. But then when he's thrown into jail in response to the earthquake and saves the jailer's life, what has Paul done except show the love of God to this crisis? And
exactly.
As far as we know, the whole town becomes a bunch
That's
of
right.
crazy Christians.
So
and,
you see?
And I'm just trying to figure out.
That's exactly right. That you're right on. That he had a choice.
Oh,
he could
yeah.
have, oh, he could have just simply run over that. He could have injured.
Run away.
Yeah. He didn't. And it became the beginning of some kind of resurrection in somebody's life. That's what we're talking about here. So, all of these challenging moments that you and I, in our suffering, because every suffering is a challenging moment for us, it is a moment of crisis and calls for decision. So, you know.
But he's not lost. I mean, that was the, I was struggling with. Your analogy there. And we have that choice.
Exactly. He had to die. You know, Paul.
He had to choose. To
that's right.
Chose
exactly.
To
Paul was a passionate man. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, he wasn't unaccustomed to killing people. He looked at the, approved the death of Stephen. Yeah. So he, you know, he was, I mean, he wasn't this kind of glowing figure that walked an inch off the ground all the time. I mean, this was a guy that felt deeply and passionately about things and got angry. So he could have had another response to that and didn't. He opened the door.
But maybe that's why God chose him, not so much for that particular incident, but for us thousands of years later, who say, you know, we have those choices. It makes
exactly.
some sense to us if we understand those.
This is the great value of being in the community of saints. Those brothers and sisters. I was reading your hymnal, the introduction to your hymnal. I was astonished that you have a calendar in which you commemorate saints. The Lutheran calendar commemorates saints. I wouldn't have expected it.
Well, you we're know, all Catholics. We just have the added.
With the fight of the Reformation, and that was one of the issues, and I was surprised. You know, and I. But you see that without the brothers and sisters who have made it. They're success stories for Jesus Christ. Yes.
Well, isn't this also, you know, this process for people in crisis?
Yes.
So, I mean, when things are going well, you know, when you liberated, when the prison has been liberated and the soul has been saved, then you're going to be on the top of the mountain. This is for those times when we're not on the mountain,
yeah.
when we're experiencing those social, spiritual, emotional deaths
yes.
that lead us to crisis where we find ourselves either on our knees or wherever, and we can't move forward. So these are the spiritual exercises to bring us back into a right relationship.
Yes. So the spiritual exercises want to help people experience the rebirth of goodness in their lives, even though they're facing the cancer, even though they've had this or that. No. That's what these help you do. And the method we'll talk about tomorrow, about how to get people through it. If I can move.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the great secret of Christianity. It's a secret, because I don't know how many of us really are aware of this. The secret of Christianity is that in every experience of suffering, every experience of death, every experience of crisis, there is the seed of some resurrection. And we learn that from the cross of Jesus. When you look at the cross of Jesus, what are you looking at? You are looking at Jesus going through death to resurrection. And this is the primal revelation of the New Testament. And so that's the great secret. How did Jesus get to glory? Whew, passage. And that's the way it is. And that's the secret we offer to people. That if you can, in the moment of your suffering, get in touch with the whole reality of it, the whole spiritual reality of it, which is part of it, a big part of it, there is for you the seed of some resurrection. If you pass it by, there's no seed there for resurrection. It's death. So this is part of what the spiritual exercises want to help people. And what's at stake here in doing that, you see, as we're moving. So I'm going along, and here I'm confronted with the experience of suffering, evil, decision, crisis. What's at stake? What's at stake, first of all, is my personal transformation. If I bungle this spiritually, something doesn't happen to me that God wishes to happen to me. And not only that is at stake, but what's at stake is the whole mission of Jesus. If I am not faithful and moving with grace toward the final kingdom, I diminish the mission. If all of us did that, if none of us responded, the mission would be finished. So every time I choose against life, in this sense, the right decision, I am diminishing the mission of the community, mission of the church. That's what's at stake in this. And so when people have cancer and they're struggling with cancer, it's not just a question of getting over the cancer. It's a question, what else is involved here? And how you deal with it makes a big difference to your personal transformation. As a person, you're not just a person of cancer, you're a whole person. And the way you deal with it has impact on our community. And that community is on mission, so it has impact on the mission. Just see why there's some urgency to help people learn how to deal with their suffering. There's so much at stake. And that's why these spiritual exercises work. Okay, I want to move to the third movement. How much time do we have? I think we're supposed to be
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
35.
Yes. Oh, good. We'll get there. The third movement, In Tenebris. In Tenebris is Latin for in the dark. It was now about the sixth hour, and darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. So what we use in this particular movement is that image of the cross being surrounded by darkness for 3 hours. What does that say? What's the evangelical message of the cross being surrounded by darkness? In this particular movement, darkness becomes an expression of evil, suffering, pain, what we're talking about, the cross. And in the Old Testament, wherever there was darkness, chaos. So for example, in Genesis, the opening of Genesis, the Spirit hovered over the... It was dark. Chaos. Tohu wabohu. Those of you who know Hebrew. Anybody know Hebrew? Did I just impress you? It's the only Hebrew word I know. So you get this tohu wabohu, this chaos, and it was called darkness. And in the Old Testament, suffering was always connected with death and damnation. So if you were a person dying or you were a person condemned in some way, there was a sense that you were in darkness, and this was a spiritual crisis. Suffering of any sort in the Old Testament is named darkness. You can find the text. A people who walked in darkness has seen a great light. Darkness. And then sin, obviously. So, I mean, there are lots of scriptural texts about this, about, you know, walking in darkness. Psalm 23, or is it Psalm 22? I can't remember which number we use in the In our tradition, we have Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. Even though I walk in the valley of darkness, that's that whole experience, you know? So the Old Testament had that kind of symbol for its experience of suffering. In the New Testament, we have darkness too. It's interesting that in the New Testament, there are two kingdoms. There's the kingdom of Jesus, and there's the other kingdom, the kingdom of darkness. And it's called the kingdom of darkness. And Peter tells us in one of his epistles, by baptism, we are transferred from one kingdom to the other, from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. Darkness is that symbol of everything that's gone haywire for humanity. New Testament uses the term shadow of death. Shadow, darkness, like in the canticle of Zechariah. Shadow of death. And then, of course, Jesus' death. Surrounded by darkness. The symbol of darkness is the symbol of everything that's gone wrong. Interesting. In John's Gospel, when John's Gospel, you know, full of symbolism and lots of things to think about. Lots of contrasts in John between dark and light, good and evil, truth and lies. It's all this business, you know. But the darkness represents that whole other side. And where Jesus says, live by me, you will not walk in the darkness. I am the light of life. You see, it's that contrast. And when at the Last Supper in John's Gospel, it says, and Judas got up from the table and left. And John says, it was night. I don't think he was simply referring to the time of day. It was night. That whole symbol of the darkness encroaching on Christ. So that's the New Testament. In Christian tradition, all Christian spirituality, from the beginning, there's lots and lots of teaching by the great Christian spiritual writers and mystics about this darkness business. Christian writers speak about a journey in the dark. There is a famous spiritual writing called the Cloud of Unknowing. It's from that great mystical tradition. The mystics always feel this, that the journey, it's a journey always to God, and it's a journey through darkness. The great mystic John of the Cross, speaking about the dark night of the soul, which is a time of terrible purification. Yes?
Dante's Inferno, he's in the dark.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's all over. Yeah, it's all over. Interesting, too, in the Christian mystics, they speak about the experience of suffering or the experience of non-well-being, etc. They talk about it as either the womb of death, at the tomb of death, or the womb of life. Isn't that interesting? That what you're experiencing in whatever you're suffering can either be for you the tomb of death or the womb of life. And it all depends on how you're interacting. There have been some great teachers. You all know Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Mother Teresa, for all her Time magazine exposure, smiling, she lived 40 years in total spiritual darkness. She had no feelings for God. She felt nothing coming from God. She was completely bereft of any inner consolation. This is the woman who galvanized the world. She lived in darkness, the dark night of the soul, you know? So she is perhaps the greatest of the dark night people because of the intensity and the length of it for her. So it's always been part of Christian spirituality, this thing. It's even part of psychology. So when people go into therapy, they go into therapy because they are surrounded by a kind of darkness, isn't it true? I mean, can't make something, can't deal with something. Yeah, they go into, and they come out in the light, hopefully, by therapy.
The therapies work.
I'm sorry?
The therapy works.
if it works. But I mean, even in psychology, they use this business of passage from darkness to light, of, you know. What we do in the spiritual exercises, and this is where tomorrow's will be very important, and I'll give you a special handout for just this part. We use the hours of the darkness as a kind of a way of organizing the exercise. So in the sixth hour of darkness, what we ask our people to do is to describe their suffering as in detail as they can, with all the effects of that suffering on them and other people. Because you have cancer, you're not the only one suffering. And people realize, you know, so when they get a picture of, oh my God, this is enormous, you know. And then the effects. So we help people move through that. And it's very important to do that because all of us are mega deniers. Don't want to look at it, don't want. People do not like this third movement. This is the longest one that takes the most time. People do not like this. They like, that's a wonderful teaching on the Paschal Mystery. Yeah, it's very nice to hear all that stuff about, you know, the skull place. But when we get into now, let's look at the skull place. Because in these spiritual exercises, in the inventory they take at the end of the second movement, we give them an inventory. Where are you suffering in your life? And then they're to choose one. Focus on it for the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th hours. They don't like it. Nobody likes it because it's tough to face what you're facing. So that's what, in the 7th hour, we help people understand a little bit about why they aren't moving out of the skull place. Because sometimes the reason why we're not moving out of the skull place is because we're resisting. We resist goodness, we resist grace, we resist whatever. So sometimes people don't have the rebirth of goodness in their lives in the midst of their suffering because they resist it. How do people resist? That's one thing. And the challenges. And in this, we're not just talking about personal stuff. So for example, a woman who is being abused by her husband, the challenge to her moving out of her skull place is not just inside her. She's got that guy to deal with. Or that gal to deal with. I mean, there's something out there. So to name all of that, you see, helps people get in touch with what it is really that I'm suffering. And that leads, we hope, to a further reflection on what are my resources? What has God already placed in me that helps me move out of the skull place? What are my strengths? And not only personally, but also in the community, because there are lots of resources, and suffering people, because they get so focused on their pain, on their struggle, they don't think about that. They don't think about family. They don't think about asking for help. They don't think about the inner strengths that they've shown in their past. They just get so... So we help people to say, look, take a look at yourself. I mean, this is all God at work, you know? This is like, if you're expecting, when you're in the midst of suffering, a bolt from the blue... God bless you. We call them miracles. God bless you, but most of us don't. And then finally, the 9th hour, it's real simple, and that's about embracing the cross. And the New Testament says, as Jesus says, we're to embrace the cross. What does that mean? Embracing the cross means I don't go looking for it. When a condition of life, the cause of me suffering, presents itself, I can embrace it. Why? Because I know the secret. Hidden. In every experience of evil, suffering, difficult, is the seed of some resurrection. Therefore, I can embrace it.
Well, I don't. And often that person is blaming, contributing to the problem, and that's very often the seed that I know in counseling. Very often, I try to break through and say, "No, this isn't your responsibility. Maybe you're contributing to it by not doing anything." That fits your model, is they're accepting that reality
factor. I think when we put the exercises together, We try to use as many of the modern insights, you know. I mean, God has blessed us with intelligence and with the evolution of our minds, you know. So we can bring it all to bear. And so you will find, in when I take you through the technique, you'll find that we're using many, many, many points of wisdom to help with this whole business. But in the end, it is the grace of God that allows us to move. I mean, we can have all this, but and we'll see that. So the embrace, usually people do end up in the making the spiritual exercises, they end up saying, yes, I can see it. Now we talk a good line about this, you know, oh, it's a blessing for you. That's lovely. But boy, to dig down and to figure it out for yourself and with the help of your cross coach and your prayer to God is something else. In this particular movement, particularly with those hours, there's a trialogue going on. That is a conversation. The person has a conversation with himself or herself. That we help them do that. Then there's a conversation with God. And that conversation with God has to do with, which God am I supposed to talk to? So if I'm stuck somewhere, and it could be any, it could be my cancer that has a relationship, and it has to do with my stuff. Cancer for me is, cancer, all right, I've got cancer, but cancer has destroyed my empire. I've been working all my life to build this up, and I can just, that's even more cancerous than the cancer. What God do you talk to? You talk to the God of providence. We give help in that scripture text. Or it can be a relationship. So whatever it is that I'm suffering, so for example, I could take the cancer again, because that's an easy one to, you know. The cancer has disintegrated my family. The cancer has wrecked my marriage. I could have cancer, it's one thing, but what, you know. So who do you talk to? You talk to the God of love. And then the third one, you know, is if I've got a serious illness, my future is threatened. I thought I was on a path. I was taking all the steps, got my education, got my, you know, my curriculum vitae is great. It's finished. You need to talk to God, the divine architect. In your struggle, there are faces of God that present themselves that can be very helpful. We help people discover that. That's part of cross-coaching, to help people discover that. And then the third conversation is with the cross-coach. So the first one is the participant. The second one is God. And it depends, again, on the experience of the suffering, the bearing of the cross, providence, lover, divine architect. And then the third one is the cross-coach. Okay? That's the third one. And that's the hardest one, and that's the one we'll deal with most in depth when we talk about how do you help people deal with the reality of what's happening to them. Now I want to take the fourth movement, and that's Pax Vobis. Oh, that's nice. Everybody loves this one. This one's about resurrection. I mean, this one is like, oh, finally, get us over the... Peace be with you, Jesus says. Now, just briefly want to give some background for this resurrection issue. Every one of the Gospels has its own point of view about resurrection. So Jesus, who is Jesus, the risen Lord, for the Matthew's Gospel? The new Moses. He's become the new Moses. In Mark's Gospel, Jesus, who has been all his life confronted with suffering, is the victor. Christ risen is victor in Mountain. Mark's Gospel. Luke, because Luke spoke with an audience that was not necessarily Jewish, but pretty largely pagan, Christians who came from the pagan, the Greek world with its own ideas, you know. Jesus in Luke's Gospel is the universal Savior. The risen Christ is the universal Savior. And then in John's Gospel, again, John confounds us because he's not part of like the other three. The other three are called synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke. Synoptic means with one eye. because they all follow this. John's his own person. This tradition was completely, when it's on its own, stays faithful to the synoptic tradition, but doesn't follow the line. And in John's gospel, you can tell by reading it carefully, the resurrection happens on the cross. When I am lifted up, Jesus says, I will draw. Glorify me, Father. Let me enter into my glory, which is through the death. So in all of John's gospel, you have these indications that the death and resurrection is inseparable. They're inseparable events. Now, John does report a physical resurrection, but the meaning of the cross for John, yes, death to resurrection. In the Acts of the Apostles, first thing out of Peter's mouth on Pentecost, he died, God raised him, therefore repent. This issue of the Paschal mystery, it's death and resurrection that makes the difference. The death and resurrection, it's central. He stands up in front of all those people. Why wouldn't he stand up and give another kind of message? Well, there are lots of things he could say. That making people feel really good. But he says, "What if you really want to know what's happening with all that's going on here at Pentecost with us, this is it. He died. He rose. It's your decision now." In Paul, no question. If the resurrection didn't happen, there would be nothing. No church, no fellowship, no communion, no Christian devotion, nothing if Jesus didn't rise. It would be empty of all meaning. For Paul, resurrection of Jesus is central, absolutely central. And he is very keen on this, teaches it all the time. The Apostles' Creed. Use the Apostles' Creed from the earliest days. Affirmation of resurrection of Jesus. The Nicene Creed, which we use often in our liturgies, 4th century. Resurrection of Jesus. The whole doctrinal tradition of our church, the whole doctrinal tradition insists on a physical resurrection. Now, I know there are theologians who say, well, the resurrection could be this. That flies in the face of the doctrinal tradition of the church. I mean, it's been constant. And even in the New Testament, you know, those stories after Jesus rose. Of course, those stories were a bit confused, you know that, because they came out of different traditions. And so they don't all agree in all the details, but there are some things that they do agree on. You know, it happened on Sunday. Women were the first to hear. Remember that, girls? Women were the first to hear. Angels were involved. Empty tomb was empty. Physical resurrection. So this is part of, you know, what grounds us. And I think it's consoling to us because as we're moving on our own via sacris, where are we headed? Even to the person whose body's falling apart, where are we headed? We're headed to a physical resurrection. So, shalom, Jesus says in the upper room. First thing he says, shalom. I don't know if you know much about the greeting of shalom, but for the ordinary Jews, when one said shalom aleichem to the other, it really meant, I hope it's all good. I mean, everything I wish you, and every dimension of your life, I wish you well. I wish it was just great. It sounds like a Jewish person talking, doesn't it? Shalom. The first thing Jesus says to his disciples, shalom. And it has this sense of the Jewish greeting, like in the Old Testament tradition, may nothing be lacking to you, brother or sister. And in the New Testament, when Jesus uses shalom, he's saying, not may nothing be lacking, nothing now is lacking. Shalom. I'm back from the dead. It's all restored. What? Shalom aleichem. And this has caused some theological consternation because if Jesus says shalom aleichem, and he's saying it's all restored, so it's all restored, our experience of life isn't like that. So when is this supposed to happen? It obviously didn't happen from the time of the resurrection of Jesus. You know, it obviously didn't. When is this going to happen? It was big theological controversy about this. And there were schools of thought about it. It's called eschatological. So eventually the Christian community, from its own experience of Jesus, its own remembrance of what he said, its own experience of life, its own constant reflection, eventually the early community reached this conclusion. Yes, it is already restored, but not yet fully. Scandalous. Yes, it's already restored, but not yet fully. So shalom, you know, for Jesus was breathing the reality into them and letting it unfold until the final kingdom. So, when he says shalom, and he's talking about every dimension of human life, so he's saying shalom to the bodies of Peter, James, John, everybody in that upper room, shalom to your body. You're sick? Shalom. And that's why the church believes in miracles, healings. That power is there. Not yet fully. So, shalom to your mind. It's possible to think straight. It's possible to have wisdom. It's possible to see with the light. Shalom, he says, but feelings. Shalom to your life of feeling. Shalom, it's okay. It's under control. What Jesus is saying is, it's all possible, it's all there, it's there. Our response is what makes the big difference. And so when he's talking to his disciples, you know, so all of the, for example, the anger and fear at the Jews for what they did, you know, he says to them, shalom. But it's not okay. You know, but he's wishing, not just wishing, he's proclaiming to them relationships. So all of those men in that upper room had relationships. Peter had a wife. I wonder if he didn't have a big fight with her before he came up to the upper room.
That's probably why he became a disciple.
So Jesus is saying, Peter, well, but Peter's, boy, I gotta get home and let her. You see, it's already there, but not fully. And then the will, you know, so this whole business of the ability to decide rightly, you know, it's there, but not fully. And then the Spirit. So all of those people in that upper room, boy, they must have lots of questions about the God of their ancestors. But first of all, this Jesus was not what we expected to begin with. And secondly, we certainly didn't expect, I mean, if he is from God, we don't expect that what happened to him, you know, I mean, Shalom Aleichem. And he says it to all of us. Now, we'll get into some of this tomorrow, or Friday. When Jesus proclaimed, as he did, Shalom Aleichem, he appeared to his disciples bearing the marks of his death. Now, let's be reasonable. If you've been very sick for a long time, and you have all your medicines lined up on your dresser, I mean, maybe 30, 40 of them, you get well, what do you do with the medicines? Yeah, you chuck those as fast as you can. You've been in a wheelchair for years. Suddenly, you can walk. What are you going to do with the wheelchair? Goodwill. You know, you get rid of it. Get it out of my sight. I don't need that. And yet, Jesus comes back with a fully glorified body, fully glorified with the marks. Why would he do that? Why wouldn't he just glory in his glory? Why would he show his marks? Three reasons. He wanted to say to his disciples in that upper room, don't you ever forget how you get to glory. Don't you ever forget. So you've got the tendency is to forget that. There's another way. Jesus thought there was another way too in the garden at Gethsemane. He said to his father, oh, please, there's got to be another way. And his father said, no. Wasn't easy for me. Sweat blood over it. Do we all have this? No. And so Jesus was saying to his disciples, shut up, my lamb. It's all yours. It's all yours. And he's showing them the marks. Don't forget how I got to glory. Second reason he shows the marks, he wants to say to them, weakness is power. And that's not the world's point of view. Weakness is, look, look, weakness. And the third thing, he said to them, you have to be credible witnesses. I'm sending you out with the good news. Shalom for everybody. Good news. Sending you out. You have to be credible. You can go into a situation of human suffering, sin, disorientation, whatever it is, and you can blah, blah, blah. You can have as much praying as you want. People need to hear credible witnesses. If it's possible for you to have dealt with suffering, it's possible for me. And so Jesus says, you've got to go out and show your wounds as he showed his. To be ministers of the gospel, you have to show your wounds. Otherwise, you're not credible. All it says is, here's the doctrine, here's the theology, here's the spirituality. God bless you. People need to see. You're talking to me, and I need to know that what you're saying to me is true, and you're saying, whatever way, to be credible witnesses. I think it's extremely important for us. Now, why do we bring this kind of stuff up? Because one of the major foci of these spiritual exercises is that suffering, the experience of the cross, whatever it is, has to do with the birth of the kingdom of the world. What you do with your suffering, how you manage it Christianly, affects the success of Jesus in the world. So that's why we don't just talk about, oh, we're going to help people feel better about their feeling bad. No, no, there's more to it. What happens when you respond Christianly to your suffering? There's a transformation that enlarges the whole church, blesses the whole people. And not only that, because we're on mission, blesses the world. You pull away from that, you are not contributing. That's why we bring this kind of stuff up. The whole focus of the spiritual exercises is to prepare ministers of the gospel that are transformed and can do their work, despite the fact that they've been through death and come to life. As a matter of fact, not in spite of it, because of it. So we become ambassadors. Ambassadors of the Paschal Mystery. Ambassadors that in some way, very sensitively, respectfully, need to say to people, if you really want to be well, Paschal Mystery. If you really want to be full, Paschal Mystery. It's a very difficult message. Very difficult message. Because we're not used to, we don't want to take the time for that. Sometimes when you're accompanying sick people or distressed people, you can't do it in a session. Sometimes you have to keep going back 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. It takes a while. But you interacting, you see, that's where you become the instrument of salvation for the other. You become an instrument of God's work. And that takes time, and we're not used to that. We want instantaneous. That's today especially. Just want instantaneous. Get it done. Move on to the next case. So who are you ambassador to, we ask our people when they finish the exercises. Where are these people, and how do you get to them? All part of resurrection. Why? If I have been given some new resurrection, I want to keep it. Not only want to keep it, I want it useful, you see. So the whole thrust of these spiritual exercises is What? One last story. Jesus was visiting Peter's house, and Peter's mother-in-law had a fever. I'm sure Peter's wife said, get him to do something. And so he said, yes, fine. So he cured her of the fever. What did she do? Did she jump up and hallelujah? And now let's have the scripture says, she got up and served him. That's it. You see that? Whenever we are restored in any way by our passage through the Paschal Mystery, it is all because we're meant to serve. We're being equipped. Yeah. Methodology on Friday. Can I ask you, if you wish, you don't have to say this prayer if you don't want, but this is a prayer to Christ in his glory. And as I say, if you don't wish to, but those of you who do, can we pray this together?
Praise be to you, O Christ, for the victory of your glorious cross. Through the power of your death and resurrection, be our champion over the evil which afflicts us, the sickness of our bodies, the errors of our minds, the confusion of our feelings, the guilt of our consciences, the brokenness of our relationships, and the weakness of our faith. Make good our hope in you, and restore us now and forever to your glory. O crucified and risen Lord.